Hey y'all, Henny here with Hooked on Crime Pod, the podcast where we talk about hooks and crooks. Hope y'all have your hooks and yarn ready. Today we're going to talk about a case that is completely heart-wrenching, and it just per near broke me learning about it. I had heard about this case before, and everybody knows who this kid's dad is, but I didn't really know much. We're going to talk today about Adam John Walsh. His parents, of course, are John Walsh, like the America's Most Wanted John Walsh, and Revae Walsh. What happened to their son is completely tragic, but the legacy that these parents have left behind in Adam's name is beyond anything that, they changed the way that missing kids are found and that children are protected, and it's fantastic. It's heartbreaking what happened to their son, but everything good they've done, in his name is just, it's great. Also, y'all, I've had a really bad day. So if I don't really sound all happy and, hillbilly perky and stuff, it's because I've had a really bad day. I lost my research notebook. I had to rewrite all 16 pages of research and re-research some stuff, and didn't get any sleep, and this is my slow descent into madness. So we're having margaritas tonight while I tell y'all about, what happened to poor little Adam Walsh. Hopefully y'all will stick around and listen to this story, but I'm gonna do the little, sponsor spot, and then be right back to get back to it. Okay, y'all, and we're back. So Adam John Walsh was born November 14th, 1974, to parents John Walsh and Revae Walsh. Today is actually the 39th anniversary of, Adam's death. And so on July 27th, 1981, Revae took Adam to the Sears store inside of the Hollywood Mall in Hollywood, Florida. And they're looking for some barrel lamps. Renee had been wanting these lamps, and so she had seen in the flyer that they were going to be on sale, so she went to go get these lamps. When they walked in, Adam sees the video game kiosk, and he's like, oh my gosh, Mom, can I go play this, fancy video game? And so Revae let Adam go play with some other boys that were at the video game kiosk with the Atari 2600. And so that kiosk is right near the toy section, and three aisles over is where the lamp department is. And Revae went and asked an associate to help her find the lamps, and the search for the lamps was unsuccessful. So around 12:15, Revae goes back to the kiosk to discover that Adam and all the other boys are gone. Revae starts looking around the toy section and trying to find Adam, and she can't find him. So she asks an employee for help, and they start paging Adam over the intercom. They've been paging him for a hot minute, and then the store manager informs Revae that a 17-year-old security guard made the boys leave because there was an argument and a scuffle between the boys about whose turn it was to play. And the older boys were asked, where are your parents at? And, the oldest group that were there, that Revae left Adam with, they said that their parents weren't there, and, everybody kind of theorized that Adam didn't really say anything because he was shy, and so the security guard just assumed that he was part of this group and made them leave through an exit that Adam was unfamiliar with. So Reveille is looking all over for her son, and she actually runs into John's mom. Her name's Jean. And so Jean, you know, she was there shopping for just whatever. And Reveille was like, oh my gosh, you have Adam. And Jean's like, no, what's going on? So she tells her and they start looking. And, you know, they're showing this picture. They're asking people, hey, have you seen him? And nobody's taking either of them seriously, you know. And at first Jean wasn't even taking Reveille seriously. She's like, oh, he's probably just in the bathroom or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, they just assume that Reveille is just a scared mama and she's just panicking for no reason. And, you know, Adam was somewhere and he's fine. And, you know, in 81, missing child doesn't bring up the same, you know, fear and panic that it does now. Is more common for kids to just kind of do their own thing and not have to stay close to their parents. You know, so people aren't taking her seriously, and time was wasted. Time that could have been used to call the police, and have a serious official search started was, you know, just wasted. So Reveille and Jean, you know, they realize that something's really wrong. And Jean starts rushing around the store with Reveille, and, you know, like I said, they're showing Adam's picture and they're asking people, have you seen him? And the pages for Adam are going every 15 minutes until somebody finally calls the police. Now I've seen differing accounts on who called the police. I've seen that it was the store that called the police. I've seen that it was Reveille that called the police. I've seen that it was Jean that called the police. But all I know, somebody finally called the police. Well, they took their sweet time getting there. Adam had been gone for over 90 minutes from the time that, you know, Reveille discovered he was gone until the police were called. And then, you know, the police station, you can see the police station from the door of the Sears. It is across the street in the parking lot. And the police take about 20 minutes to, you know, walk across the street from their station. And by time they get there, Adam is long gone. So the cops, you know, they show up and they don't take this desperate mother and grandmother seriously. And they just think, oh, Adam's walking home because, you know, he was bored or he's somewhere in the neighborhood or he's playing with these kids and they've made friends. And they only issue a BOLO, and that means be on the lookout. And so it's not an actual search. 'Cause like I said, nobody's taking this seriously. So John has recalled in his memoir, that he gets a call from a distraught Reveille and it sends him into action. And he calls a friend of his, John Monahan, a rich executive whose son, John, had saved his life. And so Monahan felt indebted to John Walsh. And, you know, this John Monahan had friends that were in the police department. And John Walsh hoped that Monahan had enough pull to get a massive search started for Adam. So, you know, John had called his friend. He's trying to get help. And he hops in the car and flies down to the Sears store. And when he rolls up, he sees that there's only a handful of cops standing around. And he's pissed. So he starts yelling and he demands answers. And, you know, but by the time that happens, it's already starting to get dark. And so the cops invited the worried parents across the street to the police station. And the Walshes unlock Reveille's car, and they leave a note on it that reads, "Adam, stay in the car. Mommy and Daddy are looking for you." Well, and there's people looking for Adam, kind of half-heartedly, but as the sun sets, you know, these previously dismissive officers, they realize that it's not a simple case of a boy that ran off with friends or decided to walk home. So when the Walshes go into the station, they are greeted by police sergeants and detectives, and they start discussing scenarios that could be happening with Adam right now. You know, he could be alone, or he could have been taken by a stranger. He could be dead, or he could just be lost and he'd be found. And, you know, there's all those terrible things that run through your head when you hear missing child. And so the radio had heard about the search for Adam and kind of, you know, let the news out about it. So the Walshes have a bunch of friends that, you know, show up at their house to help search for Adam. Helicopters are searching from the sky with huge floodlights. Police boats are searching on the canals and the waterways around the area because there was a fear that Adam could have fallen in. And, you know, they needed to explore these areas. So they were looking for him, you know, alive or dead in these waterways. Local crime watch groups joined the search. Truckers are cruising the streets looking for Adam, you know, being in touch with each other with the CB radios. And it's a massive manhunt for this missing little boy. And, you know, it quickly became national news. The day after Adam was missing, John and Reveille made a plea for help on a TV appearance for their local station. And it ended up being aired nationally, and they offered a reward for his safe return. And they shared his picture, and soon after, tips start pouring in, and everyone thought they had seen Adam. You know, he's this cute little blonde kid with this infectious smile, and he's just, oh, he's so cute, y'all. I'd actually posted a picture of him on the Hooked on Crime Pod page on Facebook. He's adorable. And so everybody thinks that they have seen him, so they're getting calls from all over the country. And the police, they followed up on tips that they deemed credible, but there was unhelpful tips being called in. And, you know, people just calling in stuff to try and get the reward money and prank calls. And, you know, whenever there's a reward with something, it just kind of generally brings out the worst in people sometimes. But like this, you know, this psychic, she shows up out of nowhere a couple days after Adam goes missing. And walks around the Sears store with Reveille and points to an exit and says, "Adam went through that door." Well, that's all they, you know, this person says. And so, you know, John has said that, you know, it was reported that they had called the psychic, but John says that the psychic just showed up, and it was kind of a way to promote the radio show this person was starting by attaching herself to the case. And the Walshes had hoped that, you know, the psychic was right, because she had said that, you know, Adam was still alive somewhere. And so, you know, being parents, they definitely hoped that their kid was okay. And they went and made missing posters for Adam. And they listed his height, his weight, his eye color, and all of his other vital statistics on him. And his first grade picture that was taken about a week or so before he went missing. Now, the missing persons posters that you see nowadays are based on the ones that were made for Adam. Les Davies is a rich and influential hotel businessman that, you know, kind of John Walsh was in the hotel business and marketing business before he, you know, became the host of America's Most Wanted. And so he had actually gotten John into the hotel business and whatnot. So this Les Davies, he uses his connections to get Delta Airlines to have their pilots hand deliver missing posters of Adam to airports across the world. And over 150,000 posters were printed within the first week that Adam was gone. 3 days after Adam disappeared, the police were forced to admit that Adam had been abducted because, like they said, if he was just lost, he would have been found already. And so John and Hervé, they raised the cash reward, but instead of, you know, bringing in more legit tips, it brings in more, you know, prank calls and, you know, just kind of shit leads that nobody's, you know, mean in what they're saying. You know what I mean? And then John and Hervé kind of become the subject of rumors while the search is ramped up for their son. Their family and friends help keep the search efforts going, and the Walshes book an appearance on Good Morning America to plead for help finding their son. So, you know, they're up in New York, and on August 10th, 1981, 2 weeks after little Adam went missing, two fishermen make a gut-wrenching discovery. At first, they assumed that they found a doll's head floating in the canal, but that they're, you know, sitting in a boat fishing in. But they soon discover that it's not a doll, and it's a child's head. The head was found in a canal in Indian River County near Vero Beach, Florida, about 125 miles away from the Sears store that Adam was taken from. Police called the Walshes to tell them of the development, and the Walshes went on GMA while police started a forensic analysis. John tells the host that some remains were found and are being tested, but they'd hoped that Adam was still alive and the newly found remains were unrelated, and begged for information about Adam. You know, they wanted the public to help them. So their friend John Monahan, you know, the guy who had helped get the police kind of rallied, he was very close to Adam and Hervé and John. And so he drives to the coroner's office while John and Hervé were still in New York. He went to go see if he could identify the remains. So, you know, he steals himself because this is like one of the worst days of his life, is what he had said in an interview well after this was done. So he walks down the hall into the autopsy room, and he met Dr. Cox, the medical examiner. The medical examiner brought out an object that was wrapped in towels, and inside the bundle of towels was the severed head of Adam Walsh. The head had been floating in the nasty water for days, and it made it hard for his face to be easily identified. But once the mouth was opened, Monahan instantly recognized the gap-toothed smile behind those waterlogged and rotten lips as Adam's smile. The hunt for Adam was over, and the coroner ruled that the cause of death was asphyxiation. And unfortunately, the rest of this poor little boy's body has never been found. So the only thing that anyone could do now for the sweet little guy was to try and find his murderer. So Hollywood, Florida Police Department started investigating the Walshes, which is typical in a child's murder. John had passed a, you know, rigorous polygram examination even before Adam's body was discovered. And so he was quickly ruled out as a suspect. And, you know, things kind of weren't so easy for Hervé. She had some issues with the investigators because they were insistent that she reveal to John that she was having an affair with Adam's godfather, Jim Campbell. And she was terrified of losing her marriage. You know, she had just lost her son. She didn't want to lose her marriage, too. But, you know, Jim and Reve, they openly admitted their affair to the police, but they didn't want to tell John. So the affair and their reluctance to be the one to, tell John, it led the police to a theory that Jim had taken his godson, Adam. And so the investigation was being run by this young detective that was stubborn and hot-headed, and he ignored all the evidence that didn't fit his ideas. And so, you know, he just figured that Jim was mad because him and Reve broke up, and, you know, he was mad that John had said that Jim was spending too much time with Adam in a fatherly role. Because Jim actually lived with John, Reve, and Adam for a long time. Because John was gone a lot for work up until he started working in Hollywood, Florida. And so Jim would kind of stay and help take care of things. And apparently he took pretty darn good care of Reve, because, you know, they end up having an affair, but that ain't my place to judge. I don't care. So, you know, John was like, hey, you're spending too much time trying to be an actual dad to my son. You need to knock that off. So, you know, this lead detective basically got a hate boner for Jim Campbell, and he didn't care that, you know, all this evidence that he's shown didn't point to Jim, that, you know, whatever anyone else had to say didn't matter. It was Jim Campbell that did it. So there was a polygrapher that concluded that Jim was not involved. His alibi was solid, and he never wavered in his story. The general consensus by everyone there, aside from this lead detective, was that Adam was killed by a sexual predator or a serial killer, because no ordinary criminal or person is going to abduct and murder a child in the way that Adam was murdered. So a psychologist sent in a profile to the police saying that the killer was most likely a Caucasian or Latino male from ages 19 to 35. The killer was a loner and a psychopath who had very little education, probably a low IQ score, probably some mental development issues, and hadn't matured much since childhood and identified with children due to his own immaturity and lack of relationship with adults. The killer would have likely taken and harmed children before and sexually assaulted them. The doctor theorized that the decapitation took place after a sexual assault against Adam, and the killer felt ashamed of his actions and disposed of the head so he wouldn't have to look at a physical reminder of what he had done. Now, that, as horrible and horrific as it is just theory and speculation, given the fact that no other part of Adam's remains were found. So no one can know for sure if that happened. That's a hard one. Jim, he didn't fit this profile at all. He was well liked, and he was smart, and he had friends, and the affair between Jim and Reve, you know, proved that he could hold a relationship with another adult. And, you know, there was no evidence that Jim was a pedophile or had abused Adam in any way. And I mean, basically Adam's entire life, Jim had access to him, and, you know, there was never any kind of thought that he had hurt this kid. So, you know, eventually a family friend, they, because it's unspecified, kind of breaks down and goes to John, and they're like, hey, you know, Jim and Reve are having an affair. We thought you should know. So John's upset, but, you know, he loves his wife and he didn't want a divorce. And he just really wanted justice for Adam. So he forgave Reve and Jim for what happened. And the Walshes held a memorial service for Adam on August 15th. So mourners ended up grieving over an empty casket, as Adam's remains would not be released until his case was closed. Which I get that, but it's still, it's sad. So Reve and John, you know, they appreciated this outpouring of love and support and, you know, the grief from others, but they couldn't process their own grief. And so they took up a friend on the friend's offer to host them in Ithaca, New York, at a lake house that, you know, this friend had up there. And so they go up there and John became basically catatonic and suicidal, and Reve slipped into a deep depression, and they had friends and family that rallied around them and pulled them both out of it, you know, to the best that they can. I mean, obviously their child was murdered, and not just even just murdered, but like horrifically. And I just, oh, I couldn't imagine. So, you know, it's great that they had support from their friends and family and help during that. And so during this time that, you know, they've got their friends and family putting their pieces back together, the police are following up on tips, and one of them was a little boy supposedly saw Adam getting pulled into a blue Ford van. So they start checking the registration of thousands of matching vehicles, and they even start pulling them over and searching them on the highway all around Hollywood, Florida. But that turned up nothing. Like, that ended up not being a good lead, but, you know, it's the only lead that they had. So by the end of August, only two people were left on this case. One of them was, of course, the stubborn investigator that swore it was, you know, Jim Campbell, even though Jim had been cleared. And in September, it was discovered that the blue van theory, you know, like I said, it couldn't have happened, because when they went back and talked to this little boy and his mama, they discovered that if this actually occurred, these people didn't even arrive to that mall until over an hour after Adam was already discovered missing. So, you know, the larger team of investigators that ended up, you know, calling for the search of these vans and whatnot, they were, you know, too overwhelmed to kind of take the time to learn more about the timing of this blue van thing. And, you know, I think at this point, because this case has gone national and international, they wanted something to hold on to. And, you know, with that losing that tip, it started over. The whole case, there was nothing. And detectives, they just didn't see it as a priority anymore. So, you know, they decide that they're going to call in Jim and Reve each one more time and interview them. And they're going to do it with the polygrapher that had interviewed them already. But the polygrapher missed his next interview with Reve, and he was fired. And, you know, Reve ended up being interviewed again, and so was Jim. And, you know, like I said, Jim was cleared. He was completely removed from the suspect list, as was Reve. And so, you know, over the next 2 years, that's it. John, you know, obsessively researches how missing children's cases are investigated across the country. And he starts lobbying for some legislature that would require, you know, the FBI to keep records of missing kids. And the Walshes, they really were like, man, you know, this is a good idea. And it is. Because at the time, there wasn't this network or database or anything to, you know, help people find these missing kids. It was just kind of like a folder just shoved in a drawer somewhere is what, you know, my opinion of it is. It wasn't as big of a deal as it should have been. Anyway, so, you know, they start lobbying for the Missing Children Act. And in October of 81, Revay announces the first project of the Adam Walsh Outreach Center for Missing Children that she opened just days after Adam's memorial service. And they were going to lobby for a computerized criminal profiling system so that profiles like the one that, you know, was done for Adam's killer could be checked against a database of known criminals. So then at this time, Revay also became pregnant with their second child. You know, they weren't trying to have a kid, but they weren't not trying to have a kid. And, you know, like Revay had said, she wasn't trying to replace Adam. You know, she knew that he could never be replaced. She just wasn't not trying to not have a kid. And, you know, a little less than a year after Adam went missing, on July 15th, 1982, Megan Walsh was born. And October 12th of 1982, the Missing Children's Act was passed, and the Walshes were credited as making it happen. John and Revay, they stayed busy. And, you know, time kind of flies by. And, you know, between lobbying and working with parents of other missing children and being parents to Megan, you know, it kind of ticked away. So they were surprised when October of 83, there had been a break in Adam's case. Convicted arsonist named Otis Toole was interviewed, and with very little prompting, he admitted to committing as many as 65 murders. And, you know, the weirdest part was when Toole was telling investigators about luring a Florida boy into his car with promises of toys and candy, with the intention of keeping him basically as an adopted son. You know, he didn't have kids, but he wanted them. So Toole talks this little boy into getting into this car. And, you know, he locks the doors in the windows and starts driving north up I-95 in Florida. And, you know, Toole gets mad because the little boy is crying and he's begging to go home, and he's saying that he wants his mom and his dad. And Toole starts talking about how, you know, he hit the boy in the face, and he was trying to get him to shut up, so he hit him in the face, and of course, you know, that makes him cry harder. So that was pretty much a stupid idea. So then Otis, he beats the boy until he's unconscious. And then, you know, he says that he strangled the boy with a seatbelt after pulling off into a rural area off the turnpike. And, you know, he strangles the little boy with a seatbelt and then drags him out of the car and decapitates him with a machete. And he also claims to have burned the body in an old fridge at his mama's house in Jacksonville. Okay, so Hollywood PD is informed about the confession, and they eventually make their way up to the prison that held Otis in Jacksonville. But it's like a 5-hour drive, you know. And when they get there, Otis tries to implicate his co-conspirator, best friend, and lover, Henry Lee Lucas. Now, if y'all want to learn more about Henry Lee Lucas, there is a documentary about him on Netflix called The Confession Killer, and it's pretty darn good. I don't know that I will ever cover Henry Lee Lucas. I may one day, but he annoys the piss out of me. So I doubt that I would cover him just because he drives me up the damn wall. But the episode there, that the documentary is real good, so y'all could always watch that. Anyway, so you know, there's a problem with him trying to you know, implicate Henry Lee Lucas. And the problem is that Lucas was in prison in Maryland at the time that Adam was taken. So it's, you know, completely impossible for him to have been there. And this easily provable lie just kind of sets the tone for how investigators view Tool. Basically, they think he's just lying for notoriety and he's, you know, trying to seek clout. And he is just, you know, this piece of crap arsonist. And but the problem was, you know, they can't completely rule him out. So, you know, they confront him with this lie about Lucas, and Tool's like, yeah, I lied, but he insists that he killed Adam. So, you know, Hollywood PD, they take Tool out on this little field trip to see if he can pick out the Sears where he supposedly took Adam from. And they go to a bunch of different Sears stores in the area. And Tool points out the one that Adam was taken from. So, you know, until that happens, the cops were just convinced that it was a false confession. But now they're kind of starting to believe Tool's story. Tool talks to investigators about his movements the rest of the day. That, you know, Adam was taken, and he directs detectives to a spot where he claimed to, you know, have strangled and beheaded Adam. So it's a rural area that's located in northwest St. Lucie County in Florida. It's like a deserted service road north of the Radabaugh Road overpass. I hope I said that right, y'all. I ain't from Florida. I just been there. But I ain't from there, so if I said it wrong, sorry. Anyway, so this is near where he had, you know, this area where he supposedly did this to Adam is near where his head was discovered. So the lead detective, he still wanted to say it was Jim Campbell. He had the biggest friggin' hate boner for Jim Campbell. And he was just, he decided he was going to be really super freaking rude to Otis Tool. And, you know, Otis is out there trying to lead him to these different places. And this lead detective wouldn't give him a sandwich or anything to drink. And so it's believed that Tool refused to give this guy any information. But the secondary detective was approached by Tool multiple times to give him information. But that pissed the lead detective off. And so he never submitted this other detective's reports to the chief of police. So, you know, there's a bunch of information that is left out because, you know, this lead detective is just got his panties in a wad. So, you know, Otis, he fit the profile to a T. And Sam Martin, the chief of the Hollywood Police Department, he says, you know what? Otis Tool did it. He killed Adam Walsh and officially declares him the murderer. So the thing that sucks is John and Reve have to learn about all this from the newspapers because the Hollywood Police Department never bothered to call them or send them a letter or a smoke signal or anything to let them know anything about Tool. And facing, you know, media pressure, John made a short statement and it said, "My heart will be broken for the rest of my life, but I hope Tool receives due process and I hope Adam receives some justice." So, you know, the problem is without physical evidence, no one really wanted to file official charges against Tool. And Tool starts to contradict himself when he's retelling his story, and it complicates things even more. So, you know, Tool, he ends up one day, he just recants his entire confession. He says, oh, I didn't kill Adam. I was working in Jacksonville that day. But later the same day, he says, oh, no, wait, I lied. I did kill Adam. But some of his story changes, like the way he lured Adam into the car and the method of disposing his body. But witnesses do confirm that Tool was in South Florida, because a man that fit his description perfectly was caught. Well, he wasn't caught, okay? He tried to abduct a little girl in a separate incident in the same area that Adam was abducted from. And this guy, y'all, I'll have to post a picture of him or something, but he's a one-of-a-kind looking dude. He's very unique looking. So I ain't gonna say much about that, because, you know, that whole mama said if you can't say nothing nice thing. So, you know, they've confirmed that he was in the area. Detectives end up finding the Cadillac that Otis had been driving at the time of the murder, and they start processing the car. They're looking for fingerprints and, you know, other physical evidence. They're looking for hair. They're looking for blood. They're looking for whatever they can find. And they use luminol, and they find 8 spots where blood could have been in the car. But since then, you know, the car has been cleaned. So it's hard for them to tell exactly, you know, how long ago it was that the blood had been in there. And they end up finding a machete, which tests positive for blood, but the DNA from the blood and the carpet sample from the car, or I'm sorry, the DNA from the blood that was found on the machete and from the possible blood that was found in the carpet sample from the car was too degraded for DNA testing, you know, back in 83. So Tool, he gets him a lawyer and he shuts up. And, you know, this physical evidence is getting harder to connect to what happened to Adam. And, you know, the Walshes are, they're just like trying to follow this and figure out what's going on. And Tool remained in prison for a bunch of other crimes and ended up actually being sentenced to death for a fire that killed someone, among other murders and other crimes. And so eventually Tool was dropped as a suspect in Adam's case, because, you know, they didn't feel like with his history of lying and recanting things and that they couldn't find any evidence that beyond a reasonable doubt could put him there. You know, nobody felt comfortable charging him officially. So, you know, the Walshes, they're upset, but they trust the police and their decision. And John starts hosting America's Most Wanted. And Revay is working on a permanent Washington, D.C. location of the Adam Walsh Outreach Program. And they almost forget about Tool until they receive a letter. And the letter demanded money and included a graphic sexual depiction or description. I'm sorry, not depiction, description of Adam's body, and offered to lead them directly to Adam's body for $50,000. This written confession convinced the Walshes that yes, Otis Tool killed Adam. And they turned the letter over to police, but still no one felt comfortable in charging Tool with Adam's murder. You know, it all goes back to the fact that this guy is basically a lying piece of shit. And, you know, the Walshes, they're upset that Tool isn't being charged for killing Adam. And, you know, they're happy that at least he's behind bars and can't hurt nobody else. But still, you know, their son isn't getting the day in court that he deserves. So in 1994, DNA was able to be retrieved from Adam's mandible. You know, they got permission from John and Reve to try and extract this DNA because, mind you, his case is not closed. So it's 1994 and... You know, he still hasn't, the little bit of remains that his parents have, still hasn't been able to be buried. But anyway, so they get permission from the Walshes. They extract some DNA. And the detective that is working the case, he's actually, funnily enough, the polygrapher that was fired when the case first started for failing to interview Reve Walsh again. And the reason he was unable to interview her was he was actually in a really bad car accident and was unable to call and be like, hey, so this is why I can't come in today. You know, I'm in the hospital. But so he's back on the case as a detective. And he goes to get the machete and the carpet sample, and they tell him, oh no, that got sent back up to Jacksonville. So he says, all right, and hops in his car and he goes up to Jacksonville. And he can't ever retest these things because the machete and the carpet piece were permanently lost up in Jacksonville. And the car had been sold years before, and when it stopped running, the new owner had it scrapped. So this new reinvestigation is just screwed from the start, and the detective that's working the case, you know, he ends up being demoted for an issue with a separate case. And then, you know, John kind of, he lost his biggest ally when it came to his son's case. So, Tool, you know, he's still in prison. He actually ends up getting interviewed one last time. And he denies the murder, and he's just like, nope, 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 I ain't saying nothing. And then he dies. He was 49. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I don't think anybody was really too sad about that. The one thing that does suck is, you know, again, like I said, Adam didn't get his day in court, but, you know, so John, he's like, well, crap, you know, I can't go interview this guy and see what he knows about my son being gone because, you know, he's gone. So John starts, finding leads, and he's working them, but he can't convince the cops in Hollywood, Florida to close the case. And so John starts working with a private eye who is actually the polygrapher turned detective that, you know, was leading the reinvestigation. And now he could finally do what, you know, he had wanted to do for 25 years, which was a thorough investigation of Adam's case. So, you know, he still can't find the car, still can't find the carpet sample or the machete, but he goes through and he is interviewing everybody that's still alive, from this case. He interviews Otis Tool's niece, who said that he, you know, being Otis Tool can, you know, he was all hand to God on his deathbed that yes, he killed Adam Walsh, and he was proud that he got away with it, essentially. And, you know, he even talks to one of the kids, a person who's supposedly one of the kids that was at that Atari kiosk the day that Adam was taken. And so, you know, he's still gone on this search to find more physical evidence, but He doesn't find, you know, the car and the machete and all that. He finds rolls of photos of the luminol test that found that potential blood in the carpet of the car. And he showed the pictures to Reveille, who focused on one particular glowing splotch on the floorboard, where she was absolutely certain that she could see the shape of her son's face. You know, obviously this isn't DNA proof, but it lined up with everything that the PI had found in his investigation, and it was enough for the Walshes to convince the Hollywood PD to close the case and name Otis Toole as the killer. And on December 16th, 08, yeah, 27 years after this child was murdered, Chad Wagner, the Hollywood police chief, apologized for the mishandling of the case and the evidence, and for failing to charge Otis Toole and formally close the case. The Walshes were finally able to bury their son, and I hope that it gave him the rest that he deserved. I don't know. I feel like, you know, whatever y'all believe about the afterlife and whatnot, I just kind of feel like it would be hard for your soul to find the rest that it deserves if you have remains sitting in a box somewhere. But, you know, maybe that's just me. But, so, yeah, officially, Otis Toole is the one that killed Adam Walsh. But there's some theories, y'all. There is a rumor slash theory, whatever you want to call it, that Jeffrey Dahmer killed Adam Walsh. And, you know, Lionel Dahmer, Jeffrey's father, had called John Walsh through the America's Most Wanted hotline and told him, he's like, hey, so I think that my son could have killed your son. You know, Jeffrey appeared to have no real connection to the case. I mean, yeah, he was in South Florida at the time and whatnot, but this was discovered after Arthur J. Harris, crime author, became obsessed with Dahmer as a suspect and published a book called The Unsolved Murder of Adam Walsh. You know, it's a two-part book, and the first part, he lays out all this evidence that, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer killed Adam. And, you know, basically, like, long story short, Jeffrey Dahmer kind of tells everybody, he's like, hey, so, yeah, I've told you guys about every person that I've ever killed, how I ate them, what parts of them I ate, and what I did with them. So why would I lie about killing a kid in Florida? So, you know, there was that. That was a thing. But, you know, in this guy's book, he claims that Jeffrey Dahmer had done it, and that, you know, he had a blue van and he had access to at the time, and he was down by Hollywood, Florida, and he was working around out there, and you know, the whole blue van theory goes back to it was Jeffrey Dahmer that did it. But also in the same book, he claims that the head that was found was not Adam's. Because I guess Adam was missing two teeth, and supposedly this head that was found, one of the missing teeth was already grown back, and it was, you know, a week between the picture was taken with, you know, two teeth missing, which is the famous picture of Adam Walsh when you know, look him up. And you know, this head that was found, and you know, he says that it wasn't Adam's head, and Adam is still alive. And that Harris himself has talked to a man who claims to be Adam Walsh. But the Walshes, you know, John and Reveille, will not give this guy the time of day. And honestly, I don't blame them. There are wackos out there. You know, I mean, how many people have come forward and said that they were like Princess Anastasia? And, you know, like, freaking craziness, y'all. Freaking craziness. So, in 1983... there was a film called Adam based on the kidnapping and murder. And after the film was shown, it was followed up by pictures and descriptions of missing children. And it actually led to a bunch of kids being reunited with their families. That's awesome. The Walshes helped form the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a nonprofit organization that handles cases of missing and exploited children from infancy to age 20. I actually, if you go on facebook.com/hookedoncrimepod, I had shared a picture of Adam on there and actually shared a link so that you could donate to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. You know, they, like I said, the legacy that was left behind in Adam's name, you know, that his parents gave for him, it changed the entire system in way that, you know, people search for missing children. Now there are databases that weren't there before. You know, the Walshes have done so much to help other people so that, you know, others don't have to suffer like they did. And their kids can get the help that, you know, wasn't afforded to Adam. And so if you wanted to donate to them, please go to the link on facebook.com/hookedoncrimepod. Also, if you ever need the number, it is 1-800-THE-LOST. So, but if you're looking for, you know, just the numbers for that, it's 1-800-843-5678. Hopefully that's not a number you would ever have to use. But if you do, there's the information. It's 24 hours and it's toll free. Also, the Code Adam program that is, you know, you see the sticker when you go into different stores and whatnot. It's a program that helps lost kids in stores, military bases, federal buildings, amusement parks, hospitals, museums, all kinds of places, is actually named in Adam's memory. And there's the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. It institutes a national database of convicted child molesters and increases penalties for sexual and violent offenses against children. And you know, all of that is all these measures to help kids and protect kids are brought on by the tragic loss of a 6-year-old boy, and it sucks that, you know, Adam passed away, and it sucks that his parents had to go through all the pain and whatnot, and that he's got, you know, a sister and two brothers that never got to meet him. But I do think that the Walshes are pretty freaking fantastic for stepping up and doing everything that they've done. But anyway, y'all, it has been a heck of a day and I'm exhausted. So I reckon I'm gonna go to bed. I hope y'all stay safe and get to hooking, and y'all have a good one.